Deutsche Welle, Living Planet.
This week on Living Planet, the eager beavers working to save Ukraine's bogs.
We pass a beaver dam on our way, and Julie explains that beavers have been essential to the bogs. Their dams raise the water level, saturating the drying peat. Park crews are going to mimic this.
Why some French butchers would prefer their cattle farmers to be, of all things, a little more British.
This is one of the farms Le Bourdonnais admires the most, and it's the one that's supplying the beef club. Windy, rainy and green, its 1,000 head of cattle feed on grass all year round, unlike French cattle that eat a lot of cereal.
And we'll also hear about the cat parasite that may be making many of us worse drivers, and one team's quest to make fish farming a little cleaner for the environment. Those stories coming up. I'm Nathan Whitcup. Welcome to the show. The draining and burning of peat bogs is a significant source of the greenhouse gases blamed for climate change. Now, a project in Ukraine is looking to flood and restore thousands of hectares to their natural state. Our correspondent, Saroja Coelho, travelled to a chilly swampland in the northern part of Ukraine to find out how the bogs are being reclaimed and why the European Union is interested in funding the programme.
We are walking along the banks of a frozen river in the Polesia Nature Reserve in northern Ukraine. Even this late in the year, everything here is still covered in snow. My guide, Sergei Zhili, is the director of this reserve. He marches confidently ahead, leading the way through the forest towards the park's lush marshlands.
We are approaching River Bolotnitsia, where the water seeps over its own banks, creating the lower bogs. This territory is covered with peat bogs.
Peat bogs are wet, spongy ground made of decomposing vegetation. It forms when fallen plant material isn't able to fully decompose because there isn't enough oxygen or the water is too acidic. But it also has another quality.
Scientific research has shown that peat bogs are able to absorb greenhouse gases. That's why we have to pay close attention to them and restore them for natural balance.
Polesia is one of the largest swamplands in Europe, covering a territory of around 20,000 hectares. But during the Soviet period, much of this area was drained to make room for agriculture. That's caused these once lush peatlands to dry out.
When the peat bogs are dry, the opposite happens. They emit greenhouse gases because the peat itself disintegrates.
Earlier this year, the UN found that worldwide, draining peatlands produces over 2 billion tons of CO2 emissions each year. That's around 6% of man-made greenhouse gas emissions. So the European Union is funding experiments here in the Polesia Reserve to rehydrate the bogs. In a nearby village, I meet Bomar Helena Josipivna, a specialist in northern Ukrainian vegetation.
The Polesia Reserve is covered with 5,000 hectares of peat bogs, upper peat bogs with denser vegetation and lower peat bogs with less vegetation.
Josipivna points out the window towards the bogs, which are now hidden behind the thick tree stands surrounding the research center.
My favorite bogs are the upper bogs because they have a lot of berries, like cranberry and guelder. You'll find all the berries of the Polesia region there. Blueberry, cranberry, red huckleberry.
She's hopeful that the researchers here will be able to halt the bogs' disintegration and reactivate them as carbon sinks.
This territory will for the most part maintain itself because it's not highly populated and anthropological influence is very low here. But there is very little funding provided here in Ukraine.
But the center has a plan. Sergei Zhili, Polesia's director, takes me out to see the site of their latest bog preservation project.
We are approaching a river which was man-made by digging it up hundreds of years ago. Grevelyan and other tribes inhabiting this territory created river bogs to fortify the area.
We pass a beaver dam on our way, and Julie explains that beavers have been essential to the bogs. Their dams raise the water level, saturating the drying peat. Park crews are going to mimic this.
In this project, we will use archaic knowledge in creating the bogs, and we will create surroundings conducive to beaver populations. We have started to create a peat bog restoration and reconstruction system, which makes use of stream conditions. We are also creating a fire prevention system. We've already dug some fire prevention routes and are mapping the territory.
This work is expensive, and the funds will only get Policia so far. But with carbon trading, the parks hope to raise money for good peat conservation. 1 hectare of bog can absorb about 15 tons of carbon dioxide in a year. The credits could be sold to businesses and governments via carbon markets like Europe's emission trading scheme. That would bring much-needed cash and employment to Ukraine's underdeveloped north. Saroja Coelho, DW Radio, Policia, Ukraine.
From the Ukrainian outdoors to the dinner tables of Paris now. Tired, perhaps, of celebrity chefs, France now has a celebrity butcher, who not only knows how to wow a crowd by the way he cuts up a side of beef, but also with his opinions on the breeding and rearing of cattle. A steakhouse, for which he is butcher and meat consultant, recently opened in Paris, boasting the best beef in the world, where all the beef comes from England, a daring business proposition in a country which still overwhelmingly associates British beef with mad cow disease. John Laurenson reports from Paris.
The Beef Club, where young French foodies can come, eat, and tell their friends that, ooh la la, guess what, they ate bœuf britannique. It still has something of the air of a forbidden fruit in this country, British beef. It was France that banned it unilaterally and totally illegally for 6 years after the EU ban had come to an end. In many restaurants, they put up signs to reassure customers their beef comes from France, Argentina, Germany, wherever, just so long as it isn't Angleterre. So for Romé de Jorianoff and the two friends from business school with whom he's already opened cocktail bars in Paris, New York and London, going English only is risky, to say the least.
We were very scared to do it, actually, a year ago when we came up with the concept because, you know, having French, they're so proud of their cuisine and proud of the product. But nationality should not be a part of it. It's just a taste that counts. People are changing their mind, actually. And then when you talk about some French chef, I mean, Trois Gros, Gagnère, they all know British beef is amazing.
But if they know it, they've been keeping it to themselves. This is not the case, though, for the Beef Club's meat consultant. Yves-Marie Le Bourdonnec, as he's called, is France's first celebrity butcher. Le Bourdonnec, butcher to the stars on a TV food show, slicing one of his trademark ribeye steaks that he matures for a slightly worrying 60 days. The New York Times gave him their Best Hamburger in the World prize. This year, he's even got into Who's Who, and for good measure, stars in a rather witty nude and nearly nude calendar, aided and abetted by some of his female customers. In a book out in February called Le Fait Boeuf, beefed up in English, he says the French must abandon their way of doing things and copy the British.
Vous avez réfléchi aux résultats dans l'assiette, alors que nous, on a toujours raisonné en rendement.
The priority in Britain has always been getting the best result on the plate, the best taste. The priority in France has been productivity, breeding the biggest animals to make as much money as possible. In England, breeders selected animals that are docile, small, and that produce fatty meat. More fat means the beef keeps for longer and can be matured longer. It's the fat that gives the taste.
Que quand elle était maigre. Et aujourd'hui, ce facteur de gras est le facteur du goût. C'est ça qui donne le goût à la viande.
Bonjour madame. Bonjour monsieur. Je vais vous prendre des steaks hachés.
Oui. Le Bourdonnec, serving a customer at his butcher shop just outside Paris. He's opening another in a chic part of the capital next month. He selects his suppliers with utmost care. The French, he says, hardly raise any cattle for beef at all. Almost half of what is sold as beef comes from cows raised for their milk, the rest from cows raised to have veal calves. The French word bœuf means the male of the species, but almost none of the beef sold in this country is bœuf at all. It's vache. This talk earned Le Bourdonnec an earful from French cattle farmers when he came down to the Paris Agricultural Show. But in the UK, they reckon a bit of French recognition is long overdue. Shaggy black and white Galloway cattle on the eastern edge of the Yorkshire Moors. This is one of the farms Le Bourdonnec admires the most, and it's the one that's supplying the beef club. Windy, rainy and green, its 1,000 head of cattle feed on grass all year round, unlike French cattle that eat a lot of cereals. The arguments for British beef are, in fact, pretty numerous, but they risk falling on deaf ears. The French nickname for the British may be rosse beef, roast beef, a comment on complexion as well as diet. But the French see steak and chips, steak frites, as their national dish, a national symbol even. All the more reason, perhaps, to protect it from this beefy British expeditionary force. And this will be the reaction of many of his compatriots too, predicts the Figaro newspaper's food critic François Simon.
French people consider England is always eating beef with mint sauce, and that's all.
We eat lamb with mint sauce, though.
Yes, lamb with mint sauce. And they never change this very simple idea. They never know that in London restaurants are so brilliant and good. Mm. We really like this idea, to be superior to the English. Mm. The mentality are so slow to change, you know, so you have to wait one or two generations to forget the lamb with the mint sauce.
Lamb with mint sauce is really nice, haven't you?
I know.
John Lawrenson, TW, Paris.
Good idea. I'm sure you know,
Generation change. From a Kenyan women's rights counsellor to a Moroccan youth leader. From an American comedy mentor to a British community volunteer. Every week, Deutsche Welle's Pulse podcast introduces you to young people working to change their world. Generation change. Forget apathy. Think action.
Still to come on Living Planet, improving the environmental impact of fish farming, and do cats carry a parasite that's prone to make humans make risky decisions? We'll hear from a researcher who thinks just that. Now, though, it's time for some news from the last week. Here's Zulfika Abani.
French energy giant Total says it can plug a potentially explosive gas leak in the North Sea by the end of the month. The company is preparing to pump mud into the well of the Elgin platform, about 240 kilometres off the coast of Scotland. The well failed nearly 3 weeks ago and has been generating a large gas cloud that has hampered repair work for fears it could ignite. Total previously indicated that the leak could take 6 months to stop. US officials say a mysterious disease that has killed various Arctic mammals is showing up in Alaska's polar bears. The US Geological Survey said in a statement that 9 polar bears in the Beaufort Sea region displayed patchy hair loss and oozing sores. The same symptoms are associated with an unknown disease that has killed scores of seals and walruses in the region. It was first identified among those animals last summer. The US Endangered Species Act lists polar bears as threatened. Authorities are considering extending that status to some species of walrus and seals. Italy has joined Germany to announce unscheduled cuts to its incentives for renewable energies. Ministers said this week support for solar power would be cut by around 35%. Other renewables face less drastic cuts. Investors have responded to Italian incentives faster than expected, driving up costs for consumers. Last year, Italy became the world's fastest-growing market for solar energy. The country now aims to meet 35% of its electricity with renewables by the end of the decade, up from an earlier target of 26%. And India has raised the stakes in an international dispute over the European Union's decision to extend its emissions trading scheme to aviation. India's environment minister called the policy a, quote, deal breaker for global talks on climate change. This week, India prohibited its airlines from taking part in the EU's scheme, which came into effect at the beginning of the year. It requires all flights into and out of Europe to pay for at least part of the emissions of their journey on the carbon market. The EU says it would be happy to drop its scheme if international authorities can come up with a better global one. Observers doubt this can happen before the end of the year.
Zulfikar Abani there with the environment news. Remember, if you're interested in more of our environment content, you can find it at our new website, and that's dw.de/environment. As well as audio and articles, you can also find our television programs there, shows like Global Ideas that bring you clever solutions from around the world to environmental problems. One of those problems now is seafood. Half of the seafood on the market today comes from fish farms, according to American ecologist Andy Danilchuk. He teamed up with an environmental filmmaker to investigate modern aquaculture techniques. Their film, Fish Meat, takes a critical look at large-scale fish farming. But along the way, it also identifies some traditional operations that offer ideas for striking a balance with nature. Reporter Amy Mayer took a look at how Danilchuk's researchers are trying to replicate the lessons for others.
Andy Danilchuk is a professor of fish conservation at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. The future of humans' appetite for fish weighs heavily on him. For starters, he says we need to eat different fish.
A lot of what civilization tended to be in the 20th century was progress up the food chain. We're going to need to make a kind of fundamental adjustment in the 21st century to understanding that a more advanced culture doesn't eat higher on the food chain, it eats lower on the food chain.
In this half-hour documentary, which is currently doing the film festival circuit, Danilchuk and Ted Kaplow, an environmental engineer, tour several fish farming operations in Turkey. The movie presents a quest.
We're going to need to farm fish to meet the demand for seafood, but it's important to make good choices about how we do that because there are a lot of potential pitfalls in farming fish.
Fish farming in Turkey often depends on fish meal imported from Peru. But Danilchuk also found a different, older kind of aquaculture there. The more environmentally friendly traditional fish farms use principles he hopes to apply in his lab. Danilchuk and his team raise tilapia, a freshwater, vegetarian fish that researcher James Webb says is popular for aquaculture.
In the United States, it's gone from relative obscurity like 10 years ago to our fourth most consumed seafood, actually. And so it's now just behind shrimp, tuna, and salmon.
Webb is showing me the system of tanks, buckets, plumbing, and racks that connect the tilapia with leafy plants nearby.
You can see these are 55-gallon drums, so we've gotten off a surplus. But it's designed really well, like the engineering is really sound, which is different than a lot of the commercial systems on the market. It's really been well thought through.
The team is striving to take the pollution out of fish farming. They're using the tank's nitrogen-rich waste as fertilizer for basil and lettuce, which in turn clean the water for the fish.
Things like that are leafy greens are the best because they really need a lot of nitrogen in the leaves for the photosynthesis processes, so they're really good at soaking up, you know, the waste products of fish culture.
This fully functional demonstration system is built from readily available parts. It doesn't consume much energy either. In fact, it is designed to run on solar power beside fish ponds in rural Uganda. Tilapia is a native fish species in Uganda, where aquaculture exists, but poor infrastructure and other inefficiencies make feeding everybody an ongoing challenge. An international nonprofit invited Danilchuk to help improve productivity. Here, fingerlings, baby fish, are segregated by size into a series of buckets.
If you grow the fish just to about this size, you can see they're about the size of your finger now. So it takes about maybe like 4 to 8 weeks, depending on how big. The survival of stocking these fish in the pond goes up to about 90% or 95%. So just the short duration in this type of system where we can manage their feeding, keep them protected, we can actually size grade them so they're all the same size, something that helps out a lot. You do that when they're young, you don't have problems later on. So we can actually make these valuable hatchery stocks, extend them much further for the farmers in Uganda.
As Danilchuk and Kaplo have found for themselves, feeding farmed fish anywhere can tax both farmers' profits and the environment. Even in the lab, these hungry fish eat large-scale, commercially processed fish food. But Webb says addressing that is part of his project in Uganda. There, working in conjunction with the newly forming Teso University in a rural northeastern part of the country, Webb hopes to improve fish meal production.
We are working with farmers in our areas in Uganda to develop diets from locally produced agriculture byproducts even. And so that's one of the great things is even though these diets are formulated, we can use a lot of agriculture byproducts like soybean seed pods, you know, and husks from different grains and stuff. And so it's so there's a lot of opportunities for, again, kind of multi-use of these waste products on that end of it. So
does that mean that in addition to creating opportunities for existing fish farmers to be more productive, there's also the potential for people to newly get into this field in the role of producing fish feed?
Precisely.
Webb says one of their key partners in Uganda mills rice for people and also makes chicken and fish feed locally.
He's just a model for success and kind of how small agribusiness can support huge numbers of people in one area.
Webb says that kind of entrepreneurship is key to the future of aquaculture. This system of raising freshwater tilapia gets its debut in New York City, in a greenhouse on a school's roof, and in Hawaii this year. Amy Mayer, DW, Massachusetts.
The idea that cats somehow make their owners crazy is a staple of urban legends. But one Czech researcher has made it his mission to prove the link. Jaroslav Fleger thinks a parasite transmitted by cats can cause an array of problems, including schizophrenia. He even suggests it could be leading to hundreds of thousands of premature deaths. Shant Sharigan reports from Prague.
It sounds like the premise of a Franz Kafka tale. There's a malicious parasite that can cause schizophrenia and other cognitive problems, and it's spread by common cats. Worse still, nearly one-third of humankind is already infected. One of Kafka's countrymen, Czech biologist Jaroslav Fleger, has advocated this disturbing story for years. Here at Charles University in Prague, he has cataloged the effects of the parasite, Toxoplasma gondii, through tests on thousands of students since 1992. Toxoplasma gondii is a type of single-celled organism known as a protozoa. It was previously known that toxoplasma, which is transmitted through cat excrement, causes cognitive problems in mice. But Fleger was the first to observe similar problems in humans.
At first I was a little surprised because I expect much weaker effects. But later on I used to this idea and I think it's not so surprising. For example, alcohol also changes behavior very, very strongly and other drugs too. Mm-hmm. So why not parasite?
Studies by Fleger and a handful of others show Toxoplasma's apparent effects range from schizophrenia to personality changes. A study from Canada published last year showed an increase in rates of brain cancer in countries that tend to be affected by the parasite. But not all of its effects have been shown to be negative. One study published just last month from South Korea found that Toxoplasma in mice appears to reduce the effects of the mice equivalent of Alzheimer's disease. Either way, for those of us that have the parasite inside us, there simply hasn't been enough work done on humans to know exactly what it does. But in humans, according to Fleger, infected men tend to be more suspicious and dogmatic. while infected women tend to show stronger extroversion. While toxoplasma-infected humans can show a variety of symptoms, one that people share with infected mice is slowed reaction times.
Well, toxoplasma is not able to recognize that it is in human brain, not in mice brain. So it do what evolution learned it to do.
Flager submits that toxoplasma thrives best in cats, and the parasite just uses mice as intermediaries. The parasite slows down mice reaction times and can even reduce their aversion to a cat's smell, so the mice will make for easier prey. So where does that leave us humans?
10,000 years ago, the situation was quite different, and possible, maybe not long ago, we were also prey of large cats.
Indeed. Flager has found that toxoplasma-infected people are more likely to get into traffic accidents than uninfected drivers. He says the chances of an accident go up by as much as 16% in infected Czechs with Rh-type blood. Flager says that could be because toxoplasma wants to shorten its carrier's lifespan so the parasite can further spread. German researcher Wolf Schiefenhöfel studies the evolution of human behavior at the Max Planck Institute in Andex. He is not fully convinced of toxoplasma's effect on humans.
I would go to different parts of the world where people do not have cats, but where schizophrenia is found, which is a pretty worldwide phenomenon. That would be my very first thing to do. I would do that cross-culturally.
For now, the group most worried about cats is pregnant women. At an animal clinic in Prague, veterinarian Andrei Skor says those are his only customers to voice concerns about toxoplasma, since fetuses can contract the disease from infected mothers and potentially die from it.
The problem is, how do you want to protect yourself? I believe what can help that the owners will leave their cats inside, like indoor cats, because indoor, if the cat is alone and there is no contact with the environment, it's really rare to get toxoplasmosis.
Skor adds that infected cats can be cured with a regimen of antibiotics. Only a few labs in the world are working on a treatment for humans. One is at Johns Hopkins University in the U.S. One researcher at the Stanley Medical Research Institute says finding a treatment is the ultimate test for whether toxoplasma really causes schizophrenia. And that might just be happening. In the UK, the National Institute for Health Research is beginning work on a massive 2.2 million euro study on the effects of minocycline. That's an anti-acne antibiotic drug which may be able to alleviate schizophrenia and kills the toxoplasma parasite. In the meantime, Jaroslav Flager is still investigating the symptoms. He is testing toxoplasma's effects on 300 students' IQs. He predicts that in toxoplasma-infected people, intelligence deteriorates more quickly than in non-infected subjects. Results are expected by the end of the year. Jean Charigian, DW, Prague.
See these eyes so green, I can't stare for a thousand years, colder than the moon. It's been so long, and I've been putting out fire with gasoline.
And that's all for this week's show. If you want to leave us feedback, please do. We would love to hear from you. The email address is livingplanet@dw.de. Those podcast problems we've been having should be ironed out by now, so hopefully you'll be able to catch us again next week on your MP3 player. I'm Nathan Woodcock. Bye for now. Just be still with me. You wouldn't believe what I've been through. It's been so long. Well, it's been so long. And I've been putting out a fire with gasoline. I'm putting out a fire with gasoline. I see these tears so blue. An ageless heart that can never mend. Tears can never dry. A judgment made can never bend. See
see these eyes so green. I can stare for a thousand years. Just be still with me.